For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Where we've been is kind of summarized by Luke at the end of chapter 4. Kind of brings together the streams that we've been describing. In verse 32, he says, all the believers were united in mind and in heart, and they felt that what they owned was not their own, so they shared everything they had. And the apostles testified powerfully to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and God's great blessing was upon them all. So here you have these elements that seem to be true in all the stuff that we've looked at so far. This incredible unity that these people had, where they were coming together, experiencing koinonia, Christian fellowship. They were sharing everything that they had. They were devoted to the apostles' teaching that centered on the historical fact of the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. And they were just openly giving witness to their neighbors and the people that they're running into in their neighborhoods all over the city of Jerusalem, and when they would gather together regularly as well in the Temple Mount, in the area where people are gathered for commerce, for interaction, and indeed for prayer as well. And it says that God's great blessing was upon them all. And that just sort of is the capstone for this whole four-chapter accounting of the explosion that caused the birth of the early church. This incredible thing where Luke says that everyone kept feeling this sense of awe. And that's what the awe is. It's just rooted in the common experience of the Spirit of God that they were able to share together around fellowship, around the Word of God, around the things that He was doing in their midst. And then Luke goes on and he says, there were no needy people among them, because those who owned land or houses would sell them and bring the money to the apostles to give to those who were in need. And so you have this great outpouring of generosity also that's a part of this group. And then he gives a specific example that becomes kind of the bridge to where the text is going to go from here. This is important. He says, for instance, there was Joseph, one of the apostles, nicknamed Barnabas, which means son of encouragement. And he was from the tribe of Levi, and he came from the island of Cyprus. He sold a field he owned and brought the money to the apostles. And I've underlined Barnabas. He becomes a pretty interesting and important figure, actually, in the life of the early church, as it's described in the book of Acts. He's the guy who becomes sort of an advocate for Paul, whom we'll introduce in just a few weeks. This guy who was an enemy of the church and who was in fact credited with the death, with the killings of many people in the early Christian movement, but who had come to Christ and was trying to get connected with the church that he had been persecuting. And it was Barnabas. He was the guy who was trying to make that bridge between Paul and the church. He's a really important person. Paul chooses him to go out on a missionary journey all over the Roman Empire. And so Barnabas is a really important person, and we're introduced to him here simply as this guy who is known as the son of encouragement. Man, you know, nicknames are important. And so some of us have nicknames, you know, that kind of capture our personalities, and some of them are less than flattering. This guy's nickname just kind of captured what everyone thought about him, which is like, to be around this dude is to just feel strengthened and like clear about the whole project that we're involved with together, and in that sense really encouraged. That's the kind of guy he was, and he led by example more than anything. He's the guy who says we've got needs in this group. People have left everything to throw in with this early church movement thing. And we're not going anywhere. We're not going back to our homes. We're staying here. And so he's like, I'm going to help that happen by selling some of the stuff I own, and I'm going to give it over to the church so that these people can stick around. So that's the context. That's the framework. Now let's see where it goes. Verse 1 of chapter 5 begins with the word but. And I say to you as students of the Bible, beware of the but. Because everywhere in biblical narrative, you see a but. You know that the narrative is about to take a serious change of direction. And so it is in this passage. We've got all this great news about this encouraging guy and the awesome things that are happening in the early church. But what? But there was a certain guy named Ananias who, with his wife Sapphira, also sold some property, just like Barnabas had done, right? And he brought part of the money to the apostles, claiming that it was the full amount. With his wife's consent, he kept the rest. So here we are introduced to a bit of a contrast. The open-handed generosity of Barnabas is being met with this guy Ananias, his wife Sapphira, these people who are sort of following along. Yeah, they've sold some of their stuff, but they're claiming something that fundamentally isn't true. They're holding back. And so it says in verse 3, then Peter said, Ananias, why have you let Satan fill your heart? You lied to the Holy Spirit, and you kept some of the money for yourself. The property was yours to sell or not to sell, just as you wished. You were free in this area. And after selling it, the money was also yours to give away. So how could you do a thing like this? You weren't lying to us, but to God. And so through, I think, the insight of the Spirit, Peter's able to kind of cut to the quick and say, look, here's the deal, you know, there's no reason for you to have lied about this. The way that we've set up this arrangement is not like communism, where it's from each according to his ability to each according to his need. We're still maintaining private ownership of the things that we're bringing to the table. Even after you sell your possessions, whatever they might be, for the common good, you do that voluntarily. That's totally up to you. It's a matter of conscience between you and God. And even after the property is sold, apparently there was also this vehicle where the apostles would go to these people who had sold their property to say, hey, we're in need. We need to release some more cash. Can we use yours to do that? So it was voluntary at every level. So there's no reason for Ananias to claim that he had done something that he hadn't. And so, correctly, Peter notes, he says, you've lied. Not to men, but to God you lied, he says, to the Holy Spirit. And what we have in this little picture is what I think is at the center of the objections that most people have about the church. And what is this? What are we seeing here? What is Ananias guilty of? Ananias is guilty of hypocrisy. That's really what he's a hypocrite in that sense. Because why? Because he's saying one thing and he's doing something else. And this I want to put forward to you tonight, not as a point of exaggeration, because I don't think I'm exaggerating at all. I think of all the issues that we're going to be discussing over these next few weeks, the kind of challenges that the church faced in terms of persecution, in terms of a number of very significant things, and there in context and down to the present day, there is no greater threat to the life and witness of the church than hypocrisy. And I want to talk about hypocrisy tonight out of this text. And I want us to think about the fact that this is not some abstract concern that comes out of the pages of early church history. Or that, yeah, that may be true, and we can all think in our minds of examples of Christians or of groups that just reek of hypocrisy. True of them out there. I want to suggest as well that we are human beings just like everybody else who falls into hypocrisy, and those possibilities exist for us as well. So I want to have a conversation about that here this evening. Why do people hate religion? More than anything, they hate it for its hypocrisy. I mean, if you just go down and you talk to people on the street and they say, you know, Are you affiliated? Do you go someplace? Well, you know, increasingly the majority of people in our society are saying, no, I'm unaffiliated. I have no interest in joining up, because really religion is just all about hypocrisy and churches are hypocritical. And so what does that mean exactly? What are we talking about here? When we say that someone is a hypocrite, we're not just saying that they're a sinful person, that they've got moral failure in their life. Everyone's got moral failures in their life. If you're here tonight, it doesn't take a genius to say you're dealing with some things, with some real failure that kind of are at the heart of who you are. You've got moral problems. You've got problems in terms of your values, your attitudes towards others. You've got all kinds of problems that you're dealing with. And for that reason, we are so glad you're here, because it makes us feel like, you know, we can relate to other people, because we're all like this. We've all got problems in the moral realm. That doesn't make you a hypocrite to be a sinner. What makes you a hypocrite is different. It's when you're saying something that you're not. That's what makes a person a hypocrite. Let's think about this a little bit. In the context of this passage, we see that Ananias' motivation was really in contrast to, you know, Barnabas is this great example, Luke tells us, of generosity, of really being all in. He was called the son of encouragement. Wonder what Ananias was called. You know, something else. Son of something else. I don't know why you're laughing, because I don't even know what it means. But no doubt, here's this guy who's like, you know, I wish I could be viewed like that. And, you know, I'd like to have that sort of reputation. I'd like to be recognized the way Barnabas was. And often at the base of hypocrisy is this sort of this ego need to be viewed in a way that's really not true of who you are. And so, driven by this desire to put a facade forward, a picture of who you want to be viewed as, but who you really are not, that's the heart of the ruse, the lie, the dishonesty that's involved in hypocrisy. We want to be viewed a particular way, and we know we're not really there yet. And so for that reason, hypocrisy involves duplicity. It means hiding or even denying things that really are true. I was thinking about this, you know, religious folk, the more public the figure oftentimes, the more scrutiny that they give. But a lot of times, leaders, political leaders, and certainly religious people in religious leadership, boy, they just blow it really bad. So I was thinking about the guy who was at one time the president of the American Association of Evangelicals. Evangelicals are a certain species of Protestant who, in a loose sort of way, we would consider ourselves evangelical, but not connected in the same way to this organization. This guy, you know, was out there, and he was really well-known politically and all this kind of stuff, and definitely for taking really strong moral positions in society. And except for he left a few things out, namely his habit with methamphetamine and his homosexual prostitute friend. And, you know, when that came out, it came out because the guy that he had this ongoing affair with was so disgusted by the things that he was saying publicly while knowing fully what was going on in his private life, he just outed him. And we think, well, you know, that, the hypocrisy. And indeed, that is what hypocrisy is. Hiding something that really contradicts what you're really saying with your mouth. Hypocrisy involves going on the offense very often. You know, it's attacking what they might call the real sinners, while, you know, holding the sin that's acceptable to me kind of behind things. Many years ago, when I was going to seminary, they would have these seminars, you know, on you know, the relationship of the church to culture and moral issues would come up, and, you know, what's wrong with the culture, and what do we have to say to it, and stuff like that. It was really interesting. It would always focus on sexual immorality and, you know, various things like that, people not taking responsibility for themselves, and various sorts of things like that. And in all the time, and with all the bluster and enthusiasm for these issues, funny thing, it never came up. The central thing, in fact, that you see, at least in the Old Testament, is God's concern for the compassionate use of wealth. Why? Well, because these are both basically, you know, upper middle class, wealthy kinds of churches and people. And it's real easy to, you know, the best offense is a good defense, they say, right? And so I'm going to really go after you because you sin differently than I do. And so you have that sense. And like, you know, years ago, although they've sort of faded since Jerry Falwell's death, the idea of the moral majority has always been out there as this sort of like scratch your head thing where it's like they seem to be against so many things, but what are they really for in a positive way? And everyone is the enemy and it's this kind of thing. And our culture by and large is super turned off to Christianity because of people like that. I think that's a terrible thing, and it's really a picture of the hypocrisy that we see hinted at least in this passage. And of course as well, hypocrisy can manifest itself as a sort of a legalistic nitpicking over minutia, things that don't really matter that much, or not being at all concerned for the things that are important, but that just get lost and forgotten by the hypocrite. I can manage to do the things that are visible that make me look religious, but the things that are really important, like, you know, laying down my life and loving people, that kind of thing, well, we don't really have time for that. So really, hypocrisy, as it's described in the Bible, both New Testament and Old, involves these elements. And to a large extent, we can see these things emerging in the life of the church very early on. And we can see it in this guy, Ananias, and his wife. And so what we want to raise is this question of Jesus' view of religious hypocrisy. I want to say two things about that, because Jesus spends a lot of time talking about religious hypocrisy, both from the standpoint of how it represents or misrepresents God, and how, secondly, it absolutely destroys the community life of God's people. Jesus saved his harshest words, not for sinful people, you know, not the tax gatherer who is a traitor against society, not against the prostitute, not against all manner of people, the thief, but really it's against the religious hypocrisy that he was primarily directing his anger. Let's take a look at this. First, in terms of the perverse misrepresentation of God, this is why the Bible is so heavy in this issue of hypocrisy. Woe to you, Jesus says, scribes and hypocrites. He says, you tithe, you give 10% of the most minute things, your mint and your dill and your cumin from your garden, these spices that you use for your food. But he says, then you've neglected the weightier provisions of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. He says, you should have done these things without neglecting the others. That's hypocrisy, he's saying, to present yourself as this religiously observant person who is so observant that you'll clip off 1 in 10 of your spice plants to present to the temple as though somehow they needed it. But you're just that observant. And that's easy to do, these outward things that make you look righteous before people, that make you look like you're really okay. But he says, how about the things that are really closer to the heart of God? Justice and mercy and faithfulness. That's who God is. According to the scriptures, if we want to know who is God, the definition that God himself gives, who am I? Exodus chapter 34, verses 6 and 7. The Lord, gracious, merciful, compassionate, and abundant in loving kindness. That's who God is. And so the people of God, to the extent that we know God, are going to have the heart of God and then be like God in this way, in the way that we relate to one another. And so the religious person, with all of their rules and all of their uptightness and all of their judgmentalism of those who are not like them, Jesus says, woe to you! In other words, you're in big trouble with me. That's what woe to you means. It means God is against you in this. And because what you're doing just completely misrepresents who he is. Jesus is the one who had the reputation of being the friend of sinners. He was not afraid to be in the company of any person. He's not like some kind of sinophobe who thinks he's going to pick up some kind of bacteria being around people who are guilty. We're all guilty. That's just never a problem. Jesus is comfortable in everyone's presence. He's comfortable here tonight in your presence. You may be very aware of your shortcomings and your limitations. And you need to understand that God is totally at peace and comfortable with who you are so that he can move toward you and offer what he came to offer. But here, this hypocrisy that he's unfolding here, this religious idea that I'm better than you, I'm more holy than you, this kind of thing, the person who's really supposedly walking down the straight and narrow, Jesus is angry. And it's the appropriate, actually, response to be angry with somebody who's misrepresenting the very heart of God. You know, if my kids were always walking around saying, yeah, my dad is a real tough guy, you know, he is so stingy that I have to practically beg him for lunch money, you know, this kind of thing. Well, you know, that's just a bunch of bunk. And it's untrue. It's kind of offensive in that way. But if I'm God, I'm thinking about all of the people who I want to communicate my love to and my care to, and to hear my own people expressing something that I'm like stingy, that I'm uptight, that I'm like got cosmic extent of constipation, I'm just angry all the time. That's not God. And so when Jesus sees people misrepresenting who he is, it drives him to anger. Like in John 2, the so-called cleansing of the temple, he says, he made a scourge of cords. Imagine this, you know, just packed out temple, thousands of people around. He takes this scourge of cords and he drives all these people out of the temple along with sheep and oxen. He poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. We got chaos going on here. And his disciples, it said, remembered Psalm 69, verse 9, which is about the Messiah, that says, zeal for your house will consume me. And zeal is just this idea that God is zealous to protect something that is of extreme value, of ultimate value. That's what zeal is. And so he's zealous to protect the picture of what's going on at the temple. The temple is a picture of what God intends to do himself. The temple is a place where God and humanity meet. And in a symbolic way, God lives in his temple. And in a symbolic way, people come to the presence of God through an animal sacrifice, an animal that in a symbolic way takes upon them itself the burden of their guilt. And so the priest confesses his own guilt, the guilt of the people, on the sacrificial animal. And then that animal's blood is shed, and the animal killed as a sacrifice, as payment for the sin and the guilt of the people. Now, by the first century, that had turned into a religious enterprise. It had turned into big money for the priests, the Sadducees, and their group. And Jesus was so grossed out by this hypocrisy that he just drove the whole thing out, because God wants us to know what he is about. That the whole purpose of history is for his son to come into the world. And just as John says in John chapter 1, John the Baptist, recognizing who Jesus truly was, he says, "Behold the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world." How does he do that? How does he deal with my guilt and your guilt before God? Well, he takes the burden of your guilt upon himself, and he dies the death that you and I deserve. That's the whole meaning of the cross of Christ. That's the whole purpose of his coming into the world. That's the whole meaning of the temple and all the things that surround it, to be a picture and a lesson in every generation of Jewish life for what God would ultimately do through his Messiah. And that is the gospel. That's the good news, that God's not waiting for us to meet him halfway, to reform our ways, to clean up our act, to get down through the 12 steps, whatever it is. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way. I'm just saying, if we're looking for performance as a basis for our acceptance before God, then we ought to look someplace other than Christianity. Because the Christian message is that God, through Christ, has provided complete satisfaction for your guilt and mine before a holy God. And he is inviting us into the presence of God on the basis of the cross of Christ. And is calling out to us, each one, even here tonight, to say, "Yes, God, I see my distance between me and you. I am a sinner. I'm a guilty person. And I realize that the project of self-reformation is a losing proposition from the very beginning. Been down that road before. And I'm asking you to come into my life, to forgive me, to make me alive to you, simply by receiving Christ's death on my behalf. I want that. I want you to come into my life and to give me that forgiveness that you promise." That is the gospel. And that's what it means to establish the relationship that God has come into the world to establish with you. That's what it's about. And so when that message, that very purpose for God's work in history, is diminished or is distorted through religious hypocrisy, it elicits a profound anger from God himself. "How dare you misrepresent what I have come to do for man, and have instead propped up this angry God thing that's impossible to please, but who you must instead. The few, the proud, the Pharisees." And this drives him to anger. And then secondly, Jesus deals with the religious because he knows that their influence within the community of faith is also a deadly toxin. And so he says, "Beware of the hypocrisy and the leaven of the Pharisees." This is Luke chapter 12, verse 1. He says the same thing in Matthew 16 as well, verse 8 specifically. It's this idea that this kind of hypocrisy, this positioning, this putting this false foot forward that says I'm somebody that I'm really not, acts like a bacteria in the church, just like leaven, yeast. Yeast is a bacteria. And you introduce that bacteria to a lump of dough, and what does it do? It just kind of makes the thing expand and grow. And now you've gone from a little ball to this big, massive thing. Because why? Because the leaven's done its thing. And hypocrisy says the same thing. Has that same sort of effect. Paul says it in Galatians 5, verse 6. He says, "A little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough." It's really a problem when we are unattentive to the tragic results of religious hypocrisy. We are just absolutely destroying the ability of the church to really come together in that humble way that we've been describing over these last several weeks. Because why? Because everyone's putting on a face. Everyone's got to make sure that they're following the script so that they don't get judged like everybody else. So you've got this whole code of conduct that doesn't come from God. It comes from human society. And we use this as a basis to buttress our own sense of righteousness and then be able to turn around then and view people outside with contempt. That's the way the church is viewed in our culture. I think, sadly, it's really true for the most part. I think that is true. And God's not neutral about that at all. To accommodate compromise is really what we're talking about right here. To allow dishonesty to take root, to make it okay to say that I'm all in when I'm half in, to say that I've given what I've got when I haven't. This kind of thing is not okay because it creates this atmosphere where it's not really what you say that's all that important. Your words don't matter that much. Man, if we ever got to a place like that, where it was okay to just be dishonest in this way, it would be the end of any kind of trust that we could establish between one another. You see what I'm saying? This is the danger here. And so, how serious is this accommodation to untruth, to the life of the ego, to bolstering up an image of myself that's not really true? This is an amazing passage. Let's go back to Acts chapter 5. How serious is it? As soon as Ananias heard these words from Peter, he fell to the floor and died. That's pretty serious. And everyone, it says, who heard about it was terrified. Then some young men got up and wrapped him in a sheet and took him out back and buried him. But the story doesn't end there. In verse 7, it came about 3 hours later that his wife came in not knowing what had happened. And Peter's like, so, was the price that you and your husband received for your land, was this the price that you and your husband received for your land? She says, along with this conspiracy that they had sown together, yes, that was the price. Oops. Peter says, how could the two of you even think of conspiring to test the Spirit of the Lord like this? The young men who buried your husband are just outside the door, and they will carry you out too. And instantly she fell to the floor and died. Oh. And when the young men came in and saw her, they carried her out and they buried her beside her husband. And a great fear gripped the entire church and anyone else who heard about what had happened. Woo! Yikes! Man, that's some tough medicine. For hypocrisy. Let's say a couple things about it before we draw out some lessons here. What does it mean that this event happened, and should we begin to worry now? Well, some things to consider. The first is that here Ananias and Sapphira, God judged them, apparently. I read a commentary by a fairly famous person of a previous generation, and he's trying to explain this away. He says, Peter had such a strong personality that when he got up and confronted them with their lie, in fear, they had a massive heart attack and died on the spot. I don't think so. I think it is clear that just as Luke is laying it out here, God called these people home. Your time on earth is over. And God does reserve that right to judge. Even a temporal judgment. It isn't to say that these people are consigned to an eternity without God, that they've gone to hell or whatever. The text doesn't make that point. There's no reason to believe that that's true. They were clearly a part of this believing community, and we have every reason to believe that they were true believers. They were just really saddled with this incredible habit of deceit, this hypocrisy. And at this moment, and for these reasons that we've been describing, God says that we're starting a new community, my community, and this very thing that has absolutely destroyed the Jewish people, this hypocrisy, will not stand in my church. And for this reason, yes, God judged them. God has the right to judge people. That's the hard thing to get, but it is the Bible's unequivocal teaching. That God does reserve the right, as the holy Lord of the universe, to render his verdict at points that are important to what he's doing in the world. And he did that numerous times in the Old Testament when you look at the history of Israel. As they shrunk back from their obedience to God, and they were no longer the example of God in the world, God released Israel's enemies to their temporal destruction, time after time after time. Not because he had abandoned his promise to them, but because he needed to put them in a place where they would come to senses about where they were at with him and turn back to him. And this is exactly what the purpose of the Babylonian invasion, for instance, of 586 was, that destroyed the entire nation, that took people out into captivity. From that day forward, though all of Israel's history up to that point had been plagued by idolatry, the worship of other gods, and seeing Yahweh, the one true God, as just one God among many. From that day forward, that has never been an issue in Jewish history. It's amazing. God judged his people, his temporal judgment, for the purposes of his ongoing work in history. This is a totally unique event in the church. There's no hint of this occurring at any other point in the New Testament. It's not a part of the teaching of the book of Revelation. It's just not there at all. This is a unique one-time event. And why? Because the effect. That's the key point, and that's why Luke twice brings it up. Everyone who heard about this was terrified. Terrified of what? Terrified of allowing hypocrisy to continue in their midst. That's what. And so that's very important. They got that lesson now. As the church in the next several chapters is going to expand outside of Jerusalem to Judea and Samaria and all over the Roman Empire, there's a palpable memory that those people are going to take with them. And what is that memory? This is one of the things that we need to be an authentic community, not a bunch of fakers and posers, not hypocrites, but a real genuine community of God's people. And that, so that was a big deal for God to put that out there right then at that formative moment. Now, we ask this question, what does it mean for us? Because it's normal to struggle. We're fallen people. We're not any better than Ananias and Sapphira. I'm certainly not going to say that. That would make me a hypocrite. And but what's at stake? That's what we need to understand. And what do we do about this? Let's just end with some thoughts about that that come out of this passage in various ways. The opposite of hypocrisy is not purity. It's not a lack of sin. It is authenticity. And God calls his church to be authentic, and that means a few things. It means that unlike Ananias and Sapphira, who are big talkers, we're called to be doers. Doers of the word, not merely hearers who delude themselves, as James says. Facades that we put up and selective obedience. Yes, I'll be together in my financial life, I'll be generous, but my sexual life, that's my thing. You see, I'll be generous with God, with my talents, and I will really, put them to use, but my time is my time, and so I serve him as I see fit. And so we've got that kind of selectivity going on in a religious environment where people, you know, we want to put the best foot forward. We want to be viewed in a certain sort of way rather than an authentic community, which is all about a sacrificial way of living, where we're not drawing lines and saying, I'll go this far and no further. Is what I truly believe about Christ evident to others through my actions on their behalf? That would be a sign of authenticity that really runs in the face of the hypocrite. The hypocrite does what they do so that they can be observed by others. So that we can say, oh, attaboy, you must be really spiritual. You must be important, or whatever we seek, whatever our ego demands that we move to the lengths of hypocrisy to accomplish. Is what I truly believe about Christ evident to others through my actions on their behalf? That's a different proposition altogether. Ananias and Sapphira wanted to give so that they would get public notice. They wanted to be seen as a certain kind of person. That doesn't really matter to God how you're viewed by other people. What matters is how we live before Him. And do I present myself as a servant of Christ on behalf of other people? That's really the issue there. We'll let people draw whatever conclusions they'll have about us. But this is the thing, and this is what we've got to ask ourselves, is what I truly believe being evidenced to others through my actions on their behalf? Maybe we're just sitting along the sidelines here tonight. Maybe we've been sitting along the sidelines in our home group for months or years. And we're vaguely interested in Christian fellowship because we sense it's the right thing to do. But it really has not brought us down to this really core place where it's not just that I'm talking about faith, I'm living it out. I'm deeply invested as a servant of God to other people. That's the difference. I put aside the facade and I pick up the towel of a servant to wash the disciples' feet. That was Jesus' example. See, if we're not moving in the direction of service in this way, in a tangible way, there is hypocrisy. There's hypocrisy. Because what we're saying is I'm in with Christ. And I want to receive the benefits of being His child, and He surely will give them to us. Absolutely, without condition. But I'm unwilling to turn around like my Father, like my Master, to serve those people that He's placed in my life for that very purpose. It's hypocritical. It's hypocritical to say, I receive the forgiveness that Christ freely offers me, but then I turn around with an air of superiority, condescension, or judgment to say to the other person who offends me, you must earn my right, the right to be accepted by me. And I'm prepared to be bitter with you until you mend your ways. That's hypocrisy. And that is a part of the heart of fallen human beings, and there's nobody in this room who can't identify with that. We have problems in our life with authenticity, with consistency. We are, in that sense, not unlike Ananias and Sapphira. We do struggle in this area of hypocrisy. Do I find joy in serving just because I'm grateful to God without needing to be noticed or congratulated by anybody else? The hypocrite's need for recognition, to be seen as somebody, doesn't understand the fact that she who's been forgiven much loves much, as Jesus said to the woman who was washing His feet with her tears. Just that simple gratitude, because I've been forgiven so much that the natural impulse is then to turn around and to give away everything I've got. That's authentic. The hypocritical person is unable to get to that place and measures their giving by the perceived merit of the person that they're giving to. is this person going to make me look better? Or are they going to thank me? Or are they going to reciprocate? Or whatever it might be. Second, the hypocrite likes to judge. And authentic spirituality, recognizing our sinfulness, looks to ourselves, not to the other. We look in the mirror, not through the window. That is a plate of shiitake mushrooms. I ask this question. Are we prepared to share your shiitake by being self-aware, honest, and approachable to people in your life? Well, are you? To present yourself to your brothers and sisters as without shiitake? Really? Come on. That's a lie. Why live a lie? We have a word for that. That's called hypocrisy. Yeah. An authentic spiritual life, authentic community of believing brothers and sisters shares that. We're self-aware. We know all the shiitake on our plate. We're honest about our shiitake because we are open with this. We're approachable to others who've come to recognize the pile of shiitake on their plate as well. Who knows your shiitake? Who are you sharing that with? The hypocrite cannot afford that level of self-disclosure. The hypocrite has to be viewed in just a certain way. They have to be accepted on the basis of their coolness, their greatness, their moral uprightness, whatever it is. And they are going to shield. They're going to hide, just like Ananias. They're going to have to hide the full disclosure of the truth. That's a community killer every time, because now we're just a bunch of fakes putting on a face. We smell it. We may step in it, but we're never going to acknowledge it. And may we never be a dishonest group of people like that. That's hypocrisy. Am I less than honest so that I can manage my image, so that I can continue to be viewed in a certain way by the people around me? That's hypocrisy. That's hypocrisy. Instead, in an authentic context where we are championing an environment of grace, we're not hiding that plate of shiitake like somehow we actually could. And we're just able to say, you know, this is why Christ died. This plate right here, that's why. Thank God for that. I don't have to be embarrassed about my sinfulness at all, as though somehow I was unique in this. We're all in it together. It stinks for all of us. And if we are willing to just acknowledge where we fall short, what our limitations are, where we are able to move toward one another with real understanding and grace, to remind one another of the greatness of God's love, that yes, even in light of that big pile, He's forgiven you. That's a different kind of community. Am I easy to relate to, gracious, and yet direct? That's a question that I ask myself. Am I, because the opposite of this would be hypocritical. If I'm difficult to relate to, it's because why? Because I'm not at ease with my plate. And in that sense, I'm hiding that plate. I'm not dealing with it. On the other hand, if I'm upfront, if I'm honest, and if I'm transparent and open about who I really am, people are not grossed out by that. That's never been my experience. People are not grossed out by the extent of a person's sin. They're grossed out by the extent of their self-justification. They're hiding. They're justifying the limitations that everybody knows are there. And when we put that guard down, here's me, here I am, you know, then people can relate to that.
And we can be gracious with one another and yet also direct under the scriptures, under the word of God, say, brother or sister, let's move forward in this area. We don't have to just stay there with a static plate of shiitake. We can, that plate can be thinned out. New things can be put in its place. It's okay. And lastly, let's be an accompanist, not a diva. And this speaks right to the kind of the need of the hypocrite to be noticed, to be respected, all these demands that the hypocrite will put up in front of other people. I really like what Paul says. This is Romans 12, verses 9 and 10. He says, let love be without hypocrisy. Ah, so well put. Let love be without hypocrisy. And then he says, be devoted to one another in brotherly love, giving preference to one another in honor. I like that, the way that he's putting that. It's not just that I'm serving the other person, but I'm giving preference to them in honor. I view them as better than myself. That's the old translations, that's how they put that. And it's just that humble idea that I recognize the gem that you are by the hand of God, and I don't need to get into an ego battle with you about who's coolest, smartest, better looking, whatever it is. But I can look at you as a masterpiece from God and give preference to you to say, I'm there for you, to honor you, because God has made you somebody really important, really special, really significant. A hypocrite can't do that. They're trying so hard to draw attention to themselves. Many of us are just this way in our relationships with one another. Got to have the last word. That other person has to yield to our will. They've got to come with the need to be forgiven by us or whatever it is. And it's just so arrogant and so hypocritical. And what the New Testament puts out here is just this sweet picture of a community where we are placing and elevating other people above ourselves. As an accompanist, I was at a funeral for a young girl several years ago. It was a tragic moment. It was expected because she had this problem in her life that ultimately took her life. And it was so interesting that there was a guy who was running the youth program in our junior high ministry at that time, and he was trying to serve this girl's younger brother, who had fashioned himself as a 12-year-old rock and roll drummer. You know, which he kind of sucked. He wasn't that good, but my friend stood in there with him and accompanied him. And made the thing, he pulled it off. It sounded good. It honored this young man at this desperate moment in life. It gave the proper elevation of this young man's dignity. We should be accompanists in one another's lives, not the diva who's out there singing their aria and bringing all the attention upon themselves. Can you do that? Will you do that? And as we do that, that elevates the whole community to something that's really sweet and really beautiful. We're talking here about a community of grace, not a community that's perfect, a community of grace that has set aside the hypocritical demand to be noticed, to be important, to be considered more holy than the other or whatever. We're just a group of very sinful people standing together under the grace of God, and we are for each other. That's the picture. And that was what was threatened by Ananias and Sapphira. That's why God moved when he did.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.